so, the citizen has a problem with the WTO!
WTO, sir!
One of the major things to do is to try to create enough of a spectacle that our media in this country can no longer ignore it, that they have to address this issue.
On the scheduled opening day of the NGO, the non-governmental organizational portion of the ministerial meeting here in Seattle, we've already had our first breakdown in security. Media and WTO personnel were supposed to be allowed into the convention center at 6 a.m., and that is not happening. Police are around the streets and security guards are maintaining a one-block cordon around the convention center due to security reasons, of which they are being somewhat unspecific. Word came that there was a security breach in the convention center and that the whole complex needed to be reswept due to quote-unquote vandals breaking in to the convention center complex here in Seattle. I asked one of the on-duty security police personnel, and he told me that it could be up to 6 hours before anyone will be allowed into the convention center. So, before the conference is even opened, we have a breakdown in security and a possible delay of entry into the facility of 8 hours, which is certainly a full day.
Thank you for tuning in to the third installment of The Battle in Seattle, the WTO, Inside and Out. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. Despite the rocky start and the numerous protests that were scheduled, as well as the various anti-WTO teach-ins and events throughout the weekend, not everyone is opposed to free trade and the WTO. In this installment of the series, we'll attempt to focus on those voices and hear those views.
We're with Eugenio Diaz Bonilla, research fellow of the Trade and Macroeconomics Division of the International Food Policy Research Institute.
Well, mainly I'm working on food security and agricultural issues, so I'll be saying that that's one of the most important issues in my view, and indeed it's one of the issues that is holding up the discussions. Now, my understanding is that there is no agreement yet on the agricultural side, along with other issues, but it was a contentious issue in the Uruguay round and shaping up also as a contentious issue in these negotiations. You have of course, is one of the basic human needs, and so there are a lot of emotions around whether you should be producing yourself, whether trade helps or hurts consumers and producers, and all in of course it's also linked to weather, war, so you have a lot of things influencing how the food is produced in the world, and the discussion tends to be sometimes very emotional, and people may not talk rationally about this issue. And you also have, from the point of view of the developing countries, which is mainly what I'm working on, they see protectionism in, you know, basically developing countries have two main productions, agriculture and textiles, and they see those two productions being protected in a way that is hurting developing countries in developed. So if these agriculture and textile are protected in developed countries in a way that hurts developing countries, so they want to be able to produce and sell more of those products. And of course, particularly in the European Union, where farmers are heavily protected, they do not want that to happen, at least do not want to happen that fast.
Certainly another two aspects of the whole issue around food and food policy and food security are the issues of genetically engineered organisms and then also patents on life. Can you talk to those issues?
Yes, it's also an issue that has been mixed with a lot of different connotations. I think it's important to separate the technological aspect of biotech, because as a technology holds a lot of promises for poor people in poor countries. You know, the world is still feeding off the Green Revolution, that technological change in the 60s and 70s, and that helped You know, you remember probably 30 years ago, people were thinking, you know, there was not going to be enough food to feed everyone. This technological revolution allowed the world to be better fed now than it was 30 years ago. But that revolution is slowing down, you know, the expansion of yields, increasing of production cannot come from the old technology. So you have here a new technology that holds a lot of promises, mainly because while the Green Revolution was better for good areas with good land, good weather, etc., this holds the promise of being better for bad areas. You know, you can create plants that are drought resistant, that, you know, resist pests, insects, and so on and so forth. And in fact, you can add, and it's happening right now, you can add some nutritional aspects to the plants that are important for poor people in poor countries, like, for instance, vitamin A deficiencies that lead to blindness in children in Africa. So you can have rice with vitamin A or cassava with vitamin A, and this is happening. But so that this is the promise of the technology. But at the same time, you have like two groups that may be with totally opposite views on this. One are those that want to ban GMOs, which I think they are wrong. But on the other hand, you have the biotech companies that insisting on, you know, it's their own, you know, their rights, you know, they created this technology and so on, when in fact this technology was produced or came through public research and is probably using public genetic material. So if you keep on insisting that this is mine, and you are focusing the biotech research on issues that are not of relevance for poor people in poor countries, you know, there may be a backlash against this technology, and the price is going to be paid by poor people in poor countries.
So the issue is something that I think does get mixed, and that is people mix the issue of the ownership with the technology, and they should be viewed separately.
I think that's a key point, and you need a different institutional arrangement and how you can finance this. Let's say, you know, maybe still private, but you may finance the company that develops cassava that has vitamin A, and you pay for that, but then that technology can be used in Africa, you know, and or you know, different type of things, because basically if you look at the traits that are being incorporated in GMOs, in genetically modified plants, are not relevant for poor people in poor countries, but the technology is extremely relevant, but the traits that are being developed now are not.
Is part of the problem with some of the people who are protesting against the technology,
right,
is that many of them live in areas of the world where food is abundant, and they don't really necessarily understand the issues of people who are in areas of the world where food is scarce?
That's a key point, I think, because in fact, from the point of view of the benefits for consumers in developed countries, it's just a couple of cents difference. And you may have a tomato that, you know, lasts longer in the shelves. You know, that's not a huge improvement. But at the same time, they may be looking at this big companies that are controlling the seeds that may be used for production of food. So they don't see that much in terms of benefits, but they see the cost or the downside of this technology. But that's from a strictly developed country point of view. From the point of view of the developing countries, the benefits may be enormous, but they, you know, you need to work on the institutional arrangements for those benefits to really come up.
What would you like to see happen as a result of these meetings here in Seattle this week?
Well, I think it's important to continue the process of having trade policies that are good for development, that are good for consumers, for producers, and these discussions basically should help that process. You know, I think shutting down the meetings or being against the WTO. Let me say this because I think it's important. Some people are talking about the WTO mainly being faceless bureaucrats, sort of a world government type of thing. The laws of the WTO are the law of the land in the U.S. They have been approved by the Congress even more than in other countries, because in my country, in Argentina, the Congress just approved the agreements without, you know, going through it. In the United States, you included, the Congress included every line into the U.S. law. So this is the U.S. law, and it's very important. It's part of the tradition of the U.S. to develop the rule of law. One of the big, the most important things, in my view, that the United States brought and the Anglo-Saxon tradition brought to the world is this idea of the rule of law, due process, and so on. WTO is just part of that. It's not a world government that you have, you know, faceless bureaucrats. It's important to notice that the WTO is run by the governments. When you see the documents, and you can read all, practically all the documents in the web page, they do not say, you know, Mr. or Mrs. Faceless Bureaucrat said this or that. It says the U.S. said, you know, the government of the U.S. through its representative says this, or the India says this, or Brazil says this. So they are the governments talking on behalf of the country. You know, you may not like what your government is doing, but it's your government. It's your government talking at the WTO. It's not a faceless bureaucrat. And all the arbitration procedure, it's also part of the U.S. laws. Basically, when two countries have a disagreement, they agree that they disagree, and then they call an arbitration, arbiters, you know. And so the names of that people that act as that work the arbitration procedure are picked with the agreement of the two parties concerned. So I think it's a process. It's part of the due process, the rule of law at the world level, and the U.S. And all the countries that have been working on this, I think they should be proud that this is improving the structure of the legal institutions and the rule of law and due process at the world level.
What's very clear is that there's no monolithic view of world trade and the World Trade Organization. Quite often, those in the developed economies see things very differently from those in the developing world. Professor Jagdish Bhagwati of Columbia University.
Let me try and inject something a little more professorial in the debate, because that's what I am. I was only an offshore advisor to the GATT for a couple of years in 91 to 93, and I have studied development and trade for about 40 years, and I do actually share some of the concerns which Vandana, who is also an old friend from my original country, India, about some of the things which we have put into the WTO, where you people who are cheering today were not vigilant and were not coming to our aid. So we have to think about democracy not in terms of narrow self-interest of Americans, but really in terms of how we design the WTO, and that complicates life, I'm afraid, very, very badly. So let me come back to that issue. Now, I think what we have seen in the streets today is really a lot of fear about globalization, and I think it's reasonable that people are afraid of it. It's a strange, new Frankenstein sort of fear of something which is really beyond ourselves, which is sort of gnawing at our sides. And I think we have to, on our side of the street, to speak to that and say, look, this fear is really not, I mean, it's reasonable to have it, but it's really not justified. So I'm going to make an argument which won't bring you to your feet, which I hope you will appreciate, because two push-ups a day is about good and, you know, the maximum which most of us can manage. So let me just say that I think these fears are not totally, are really not justified. And you can, you know, I'll give it a shot. I think the freeing of trade, and I'm not talking about short-term capital flows and so on which I've written, which has been really disastrous, which really brought about the Asian financial crisis, which we have tried desperately to blame on Asia rather than on ourselves. That is the kind of globalization I'm not in favor of, okay? Without a great deal of monitoring, regulation, and much more prudentially than we actually, unfortunately, pushed ourselves into. But that's an IMF story, not a WTO story, okay? And it's IMF, Treasury, G7, etc. So let's put that out of the way and concentrate on trade, and I'll bring in a little bit of foreign investment. I think if you look at the post-war period, not just the last few years, where you were rather derisive of my friend Mr. Aaron on the right, when he talked about how Indonesia, et cetera, had improved, unfortunately they did improve from your perspective. But over a protracted period, they were brought to their knees, actually. They deteriorated very sharply. And we didn't pay enough attention to the democratic aspects of what was going on in Asia. I mean, things like crony capitalism today are fashionable ways of distracting attention from our own mistakes in policymaking. But when people like me pointed out that, you know, Suharto was not exactly someone to admire, nobody would hear us in Washington, okay? So that's a bit of you. Take just simply prosperity and its effect on poverty. There's no question in my mind that countries like Korea, Indonesia, which over the years integrated more into the world economy and used external opportunity without succumbing to the fears of global integration, they did pretty well. And countries like mine in India, for three decades, you know, we had very inward-looking policies, and the amount of foreign investment in 91 when we began our market-oriented reforms was $100 million. That's the Columbia University budget is bigger than that. So, you know, you couldn't say that, you know, this was really something which was devastating, you know, which really... We simply were not using the opportunity. Ever since we started using trade and investment, our growth rate has doubled virtually. And growth does sometimes, you know, accord with common sense and bring more people into gainful employment. And that's what we have pulled up many people into gainful employment. Even social agendas like literacy improve and, you know, poor impoverished parents who are otherwise sending their children into employment to survive are then able to take them out and send them to schools, which otherwise remain unfilled. So I would say I am, in terms of experience, not just armchair arguments, in favor of freer trade. Now, when it comes to the WTO, that's the institution which oversees trade, and just give me 1 minute on this, that's a separate issue. And I think, again, you have to see it from a different perspective. These are rules which are devised by member governments. But a lot of us from the poor countries think of these as protection against you guys included. You people are based here in the United States. You're thinking of child labor. I don't know how many children you have seen in my part of the world. Poor children go to work because of poverty. If you want to make an impact on it, don't go to the WTO, go to the ILO. And think about the fact that if you really want to stop trade because of child labor and of unionization, 14% of your labor force is unionized. Stop trade of your own country, all right, of your exports, wherever there are no unions. Don't tell me unions are not busted in this country. So if you really want to make an impact, look at your own navel and don't just cheer it, you know, when it comes to third parties. We in India look upon the WTO as a defense of the weak to protect us from you people, right? And to have a more symmetric view of labor standards, environment rights, and so on. Don't come at us through the WTO, okay? We have had our intellectual property protection thrown at us. Now you want to say because you people ripped us off with intellectual property protection, WTO. Now you want to do it by attacking what we do with labor.
Professor Bhagwati, let me ask you, because a lot of what I heard in your statements at tonight's debate seemed to be a chastisement of the developed world attempting to put its morality on the developing world. Was I right in hearing that?
Not quite, because I do believe we ought to throw stones at other people's glass houses, and wherever we see moral defects, let us be articulate. Let's have an open mouth policy. But I think it has to be symmetric for it to be taken seriously. If our governments are persuaded to go ahead and say, look, let's object to child labor, which is very complicated problem for people to solve. It's not like you have a few children working in rugs or something. You've got about 100 million children in Asia and about 200 according to ILO estimates around the world. This is a complex poverty-related problem, as the Claire Short, the development minister, who's come here from UK, and she's a left-wing progressive lady. And she doesn't want trade sanctions and so on. So I think the argument I have is that let's put these moral agendas where we can systematically look at them in global terms, where people don't feel in the other countries that, you know, we are sort of being self-serving and simply looking at their problems, not at our own. So like when the president is going to India, for example, very likely around February, and I've written to him suggesting that we should set up a binational commission where the Indian party on human rights, where the Indian party looks at the child labor and because they know about child labor more than we do, right? And they will look out, they'll take systematic steps and a schedule. And we, on our part, also take an obligation to look after our sweatshops and New York Garment District, etc., look after our migrant labor problems, look after the illegal immigrants, you know, human rights and so on, because these are our problems. But you see, then it looks more symmetric, like Doctors Without Borders, you know, that it doesn't look like we're just trying to advance an agenda because we're really worried about competition from child labor. A lot of people are just simply afraid of globalization. So they really are trying to think of morally driven issues, which really also happen to be ones where we would reduce competition. And that's why they go to the trade agenda, you see, for it. Like, I mean, the analogy I use is that if you feel a beast called globalization is charging at you and you feel threatened, you either can try and seize it by the horns, and that is just straightforward import protection. But that's become a bad word now, you know, thanks to us free traders' activities. So what do we do? Another way to break the charge of the beast is to reach behind it and to catch it by the tail. And this is what part of the problem is, that we, you know, our unions and, you know, quite naturally being worried about foreign competition say, oh, well, it's unfair to have child labor compete with us. So they're really catching the beast by the tail and hoping to moderate its charge. But I would say, I mean, that's another part of the story about labor itself, that I think the president has done a very inadequate job of even talking to people like John Sweeney, who, in my opinion, are good-hearted people, you know, who are not unsympathetic to, say, immigrants and so on. I mean, I've read John Sweeney's book, and he's a great guy in my judgment, you know, speaks from the heart, has solidarity with people coming in from abroad, and he just has bought his own pseudo-economist argument that trade is hurting our labor, so naturally he worries about it, okay? But it seems to me that if you really look at it in some detail, the case for saying that freer trade and competition is hurting our workers is not really that compelling. I mean, this is based on some studies I've undertaken, but the president has never sat down, to my knowledge, with Mr. Sweeney and said, look, your fears are, I can understand, but really they're not really serious, so let's try and stick to the moral aspect of our agenda of extending union rights, unionization in China. And then let's work in the ILO, in appropriate agencies, and let's try and work it as part of the human rights agenda in a broader sense.
Perhaps, as might be expected, Sir Michael Moore, Director General of the World Trade Organization, is one of its staunchest defenders.
What are we fighting for here in Seattle? We are fighting for a multilateral trading system that is an essential component of the architecture of international cooperation. A firm foothold in an uncertain world. The world would not be a safer place without the UN, IMF, World Bank, World Health Organization, or the WTO, despite all our imperfections. The GATT WTO system is a force for international peace and order, a fortification against disorder. This is reason enough to insist on the rightness of what we are doing. We're also fighting to reduce poverty, to create a more inclusive world. We all want a fairer world, a world of opportunity accessible to all. Just ask the mother with a sick child. She wants the best medical advice the world has to offer. She's a globalist. She doesn't care whether that research is done in Boston or Oxford or Johannesburg. And technology has, and science, brought benefits to our species and to ordinary people. When I was a boy, the greatest gift a working class family or father or mother could give was a set of the Encyclopedia Britannia. We never got one. That took a year's work in my wealthy country to deliver. It's now free on the internet. Or you can buy a CD, which in my country is now the equivalent of 1 week's pay for an unemployed person with two children. None of us want to visit a dentist based on the technology of 20 years ago. And think of the future of what technology and science could do for education and health. Again, though, it is a matter of redistribution, not a matter of stopping. The old divides of north and south, of left and right, don't apply in the same way. What divides us today is the difference between those who would welcome the future and those who fear it.
I asked Director General Michael Moore what he thought about the WTO ministerial meetings and the protests that had been happening in Seattle, Washington.
I think they're going as predicted. There are great issues at stake. The needs of a farmer in Switzerland are slightly different than the needs of a farmer in the Midwest. The needs of Papua New Guinea are slightly different than the needs of France. So you've got 130 or so ministers. All have the right to make a case, and in that we've got to find some balance. And other than the opening ceremony, in which the ministers were given the freedom of hearing a boring speech from me, everything is working really according to plan in terms of giving ministers chances. But you realise the enormous issues that are at stake for Brazil, for Uruguay, these things have a rhythm to them. They're a bit like one of those Olympic cycle races where they stand on the old pedals and looking at the line and then down they go. So, but it is serious, and I think it'll be a long day. I bought a clean shirt. Okay.
We asked Michael Moore what he thought about the protests in Seattle as well.
The ministers understood that. We have ministers represented who have been imprisoned in South Africa. We've got advisors and ministers who help tear down the Iron Curtain. These are brave men and women. They simply want their First Amendment rights to be able to put the case of their families, their countries, and they are. And President Clinton is deeply admired by ministers, and the United States as host has done a good job. We have had one or two hiccups, but it hasn't delayed our work, and we know that the one or two hooligans who are real tough guys who want to throw a rock at a defenceless window, that takes guts. They don't represent the protesters, let alone the people of America. You know what we want in this organisation, strangely? Lesotho, Papua New Guinea, they want to live up to some of the ideals that created America. That is freedom and an opportunity and a chance to give it a go, to take your family up to a better living standard.
Thanks for tuning in to the third installment of our series, The Battle in Seattle, the WTO, Inside and Out. The program has been made possible with generous support from KVMR FM Radio, Nevada City, the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, and is produced in conjunction with Full Logic Reverse Productions. My name is Mike Thornton. It's been my pleasure to be your host. I hope you'll tune in next time for our next installment of The Battle in Seattle, the WTO, Inside and Out.
So, the citizen has a problem with the WTO!
WTO, sir!